Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the ESI Bytes show. The goal of ESI Bytes is to offer an educational content online and podcast free from any sort of vendor pressures, really just to educate people on ESI at a price anyone can afford, which is free. Also, at a price you can afford in terms of your time. You can download these shows when you have time to listen to them. And I'm pleased that we have Stephanie Tess Blair on the show from Morgan Lewis. Tess, this is your second show with us. We did a three-second show earlier, which I started before you got online. So,
yes, and that was brilliant.
You're the first repeat guest on the show, so congratulations. Anyway, couple of housekeeping items. I see we have a couple of guests on. If you had questions about eDiscovery, at the end you could ask a question by hitting *8 or just post a chat question, and I'm happy to unmute you and you can ask questions. What we're going to talk about today is a little bit about some of the issues that Tess sees in eDiscovery, and I want to introduce your background a little bit. You've got a really phenomenal background. You're the leader of the eData group at the AmLaw 100 law firm Morgan Lewis, involved with all sorts of influential groups, Sedona Conference, ARMA, the EDRM Model Working Group. You've written a chapter of a book that I wrote a chapter in, the eDiscovery book by PBI that came out in November, which was a nice chapter. And you've been on audio broadcasts with me before with BNA, that some of the shows I did in the past. So, Stephanie, I'm glad you're on. I go between Stephanie and Tess. I'm sure this happens all the time to you.
But all my friends call me Tess, so please feel free.
Okay. Well, first let's start off with your background here. Talk to me about your career. How did you become interested and familiar with eDiscovery and electronically stored information?
Sure. I've been with Morgan Lewis my entire career. Started as an associate in our litigation practice in the late 90s. And from the very first case I had, there was what we would now call an electronic discovery component. I don't think we understood it to be that at the time. So really from the outset of my career, I've been involved in massive litigations involving discovery of a very broad scope. In fact, my very first case was a product liability matter. It was actually 7 class actions and then scores of individual actions that we were defending. And so we had a massive discovery effort in that case. And I laugh now because back then, 500 boxes of paper was considered massive. And as we all know, one mailbox in a modern case might be the paper equivalent of something we considered massive back in the day. So that's how I got started. I did form a practice group devoted to electronic records management and electronic discovery back in 2004. And this was because we sensed in our practice a real demand and a lack of knowledge in this area. And of course, at the time, the amended federal rules were, still a concept and still winding their way through the approval process. And so we were preparing our clients long before electronic discovery became a formal practice area. 2004, as I mentioned, I started our new practice group. Since that time, we've grown. I now command a workforce of about 150 folks who address all aspects of electronic discovery and records management.
We used to joke early on that the only real growth field in eDiscovery was the CLE circuit, where people go and talk about this, but except for some high-profile cases, it was sort of percolating along, and I think we're past that point. We're getting past it. But why do you think there's such a challenge presented for lawyers in this field?
Well, it's a challenge in a number of ways, but most fundamentally, this is brand new. I mean, there's a new lexicon. This addresses technology which, at least in my experience, many lawyers, they're not technophobic, but they don't see technology perhaps the way that you and I do now, that we see it as kind of the forefront of the discovery process. And so there's a lack of knowledge. There's a lack of familiarity with the real significant challenges that it presents. I will frequently run across lawyers who say, I don't understand what the big deal is. It's just discovery. and we've all been doing discovery our whole careers, but this is really something new altogether. So there's that. There's just a fundamental lack of understanding. The other real challenge that it presents for any lawyer practicing is the volume and the cost of discovery, which is exponentially greater than, again, what we were accustomed to when we were practicing in a paper world. And so the volume and cost create a new set of challenges in and of themselves. And then, of course, the risk. The high-profile cases that have really put electronic discovery front and center with our clients have driven up the risk. I mean, Morgan Stanley, Zubelake, and then, of course, for lawyers, you know, Qualcomm sent shivers down our spines. And so it presents an area of just extraordinary risk, combined with lack of knowledge, extraordinary cost, pressures from our clients to drive down the costs. It's just extraordinarily challenging, unlike anything we've really seen before.
Well, if you're looking out now into the future or in 2009, where do you see the biggest challenges ahead in this field?
The biggest challenges now, I mean, now that we're all acclimated to the fundamental question of, you know, do we have to do this? The answer is yes. Electronic discovery is here and it's here to stay. It's not a fad. So I think we've gotten over kind of the initial shock and awe of it. Now we're looking for more cost-effective, more efficient ways to manage the volume and the cost. And I think that's where we're moving now. Everyone has learned the lessons of Zubelake and Morgan Stanley and other cases where failure to preserve, failure to issue a legal hold and so forth were the real risk. I think we're doing a marginally good job there. Now we're looking at how can we do better at managing a process that we all agree now we have to do.
Well, if you see a case starting, you know, you start with a client with a problem, okay? Where do you sense clients typically, when they make mistakes in these cases, make their mistakes?
The fundamental error is the failure to plan out and think through the discovery process and to make it part of your litigation strategy from day one of your case. If you're going to do electronic discovery on an ad hoc basis, you're going to pay a premium for that, you're going to make mistakes, and there's going to be a lot of wasted effort that could be outcome determinative. And so in my experience, clients who wait until late in the day or put off answering the tough questions about their electronic discovery strategy, you know, make incredible errors and waste a lot of time and effort. And so failing to bring in the requisite expertise from the very beginning of the case to help you formulate your electronic discovery strategy is a critical error. Not maximizing those precious few opportunities that present themselves, at least to my client base, to take control of the process is another place where I think my client base at least tends to make mistakes. Now, understand, my practice is typically representing Fortune 500 companies, typically on the defending end of a litigation, and typically, frankly, bearing the greatest electronic discovery burdens because they have such enormous stores of data. And so in my view, there are few opportunities for a corporate defendant like a client of mine to really take control of the discovery process. But where they do have those opportunities, a lot of companies are not recognizing them and not capitalizing on them.
You know, litigation, as we're aware, is an adversarial process, and that's just the nature of it. One side is going to win, and the other side's going to lose, and that's the battle. When you're in an e-discovery fight against an adversary, sometimes you think, wow, that person's good. You know, they're an adversary. I'm going up against someone that's really challenging. Sometimes you think, oh, my God, this person just doesn't get it. Where do you think adversaries sometimes make the biggest mistake in this area to cause you to think, oh, my God, this person just doesn't get it?
Right. Two key areas where I see my opposing counsel make enormous mistakes. First of all, overreaching. The days of gamesmanship and overly broad demands are over. The courts, the cases, the commentators, people like me and you who do this for a living, are trying to find a balance between the need for effective discovery and cost. And where your opponent comes in and they want the sun and the moon and the stars, you know, they want all of your servers and all of your email accounts for the whole company, those kinds of demands are going to be rejected by courts. So overreaching is the first thing that I see my opponents making a huge mistake on. The second is opposing parties suffering from the same lack of knowledge that many attorneys on this side of the V suffer from. I have suffered through lots of meetings with plaintiff's lawyers, and I tend to think of them as plaintiff's lawyers, who throw out a lot of technical terms, and then when I ask them what they mean, they have no idea. They're following a script, or they've borrowed a set of interrogatories or document requests from someone else, and they don't understand what they're asking for. And so they suffer from those two things: asking for too much, overreaching, refusing to compromise, and not understanding what it is they're asking for and what burdens it places on my clients.
Yeah, there's that recent Judge Facciola decision where they were asking for staple documents.
Yeah.
That was an interesting one. Now, you know, I've written a little bit in this area, and I'm curious what your thoughts are about collaboration. And we talked about working with the adversary on trying to be real about what the case is about. But where do you see the issues when you're working on a multidisciplinary team? Is collaboration as big a challenge within a team as it is, you know, working with the other side?
It is. And I actually think that the need for collaboration is far more real on multi-part teams, if you will, where you have, you know, outside lawyers, you have in-house lawyers, you have in-house IT people, you have outside technology consultants, you have electronic discovery vendors, you have staffing agencies. I mean, there are a lot of moving parts in a typical case today. And so the need for collaboration is much more important on these teams, frankly, than right now it is with your adversaries. Now, I think that there's an absolute need for better cooperation between the parties in litigation, but I think the real demand for it's mission critical, frankly, on the team that's managing one party's discovery efforts.
Is your sense at this point, I mean, you've been involved with Sedona for a while, a long time, where, you know, that was a very influential think tank for those that aren't familiar, trying to handle this area and get better education out there for everyone. Do you think we're at a point now where enough of at least the larger law firms get it, or are we still in the world of experts who have been to a couple of training courses and read a little bit, you know, they're perceived experts, and it's still real challenging? I mean, are we getting better here, or is this still in the learning process?
I think we are getting better. I think it's fair to say that, again, as the profession in general has become more comfortable with the concept of electronic discovery, I think we've improved our knowledge base. I think Sedona has done remarkable work. I'm excited about the cooperation proclamation that the group has issued, and I think that there is at least some hope that there will be a more collaborative process between adversaries in litigation to drive down the costs, to better define the scope of discovery, and to get back to the original intent of the discovery process, which is to share the information that's necessary for the parties to put their cases together. I don't think we're there yet. I think that much of the profession still regards discovery as kind of a necessary evil, a place where a lot of gamesmanship still occurs. But it's clear from the cases and from the commentary by a really active bar of judiciary in this area, not just Judge Fasciola, but Judge Grimm and a host of other judges who have really gotten out in front of this issue. They demand better cooperation, more collaboration, a better dialogue between the parties, and I think that that's what's going to drive it, and we're going to see continued improvement in the coming years as far as agreements on the scope of discovery and the conduct and form of production and so forth.
Now, since we still are in a field that's developing, and you know, it's turned into sometimes you know, it can be expensive, but cost containment in this era is something I think everyone's talking about. Are there any strategies you can think of to reduce costs in this area that seem like they might be helpful?
Well, there are a number of strategies out there, and I have opinions on the efficacy of a lot of them. We've heard, for example, talk over the last several years of offshoring or legal process outsourcing. And that addresses the labor issue. You know, do we want to pay U.S. domestic contract attorneys or domestic law firm associates versus perhaps lower cost legal professionals and others offshore, you know, India, the Philippines, where have you, to do this work. I think that only gets us part of the way there, and I actually don't think that LPO has gotten the traction that I think its proponents had hoped for. I think there's still a lot of reluctance to do that. I also don't think it solves the problem. And the problem with electronic discovery, particularly in this environment where we're looking to reduce costs, it's the problem of volume. So even if you're paying substantially less per hour for attorneys or others to review your documents, if you're still looking at terabytes of documents, you're still going to sustain significant costs. And so I'm optimistic that some of the new technologies, the new approaches, some of the new cases that have come out that go to the heart of the problem of volume, I think are really going to have an impact on cost. And so I'm optimistic about that. Also, I think that the move away from the billable hour for document review is critically important to giving our clients the transparency and the certainty that they need in managing their budgets and reducing their legal spend in this area. And so my firm, for one, is moving away from hourly billing. We're doing all-in pricing for our discovery work so that they get one bill and they're told up front what it's going to be when a discovery project is launched. So those two pieces, I think, are much more important than some of these other Band-Aid type approaches like LPO.
Well, also, thanks for some of the good ideas on future shows. A couple of those topics, I think, are well worth shows completely in their own, you know, right. In terms of educating, you know, we did, I think, a really nice show earlier in the week with Judge Fasciola and a solo practitioner. He is deeply concerned about the lack of knowledge throughout the legal profession. Do you think this is something that even law schools should jump in and start teaching people, students, early on about this area instead of waiting for them to become practicing attorneys?
I actually do. I think that more practical lawyering needs to be taught in the law schools about the discovery process. I think some law schools do a better job than others. I know we have some programs in the local area, in the Philadelphia area, that teach electronic discovery and discovery generally to young would-be lawyers. We have some lawyers in our firm who did take those courses, and it's clear to me that they're much more comfortable with the process and understanding their role in it. Because, I mean, let's face it, in an Am Law 100 firm, it's usually the very young associates who are tasked with the primary responsibility for discovery. And in my practice, working with young associates who have had that kind of coursework is a much less challenging process for us than it is for associates who are not familiar with it. So I think that the schools can do a better job of that. But I also think that lawyers, all of us, anyone who litigates, has to become familiar with the amended federal rules and has to educate themselves, whether taking CLE courses or doing some reading. We all need to become better educated.
Well, that's fantastic. I appreciate you joining us on this this show. I want to let everyone know that in about 3 weeks, we'll have the website up, esibytes.com, where the show will be housed, and we'll have a link back to a bio page on Tess and her practice area. But thank you for joining us. I hope you can join us on future shows. So,
Carl, thanks for having me.
Anything else you want to add about the field, or you think this is I think you've provided a real nice general overview of where we are right now, like a balance sheet.
Sure. Well, and I'm happy to talk further about, you know, any of the issues that I raised today.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot.
All right, Carl.
Take care.
Bye.